Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forces, and as usual, I'm joined by Stephanie Carvin, this time over the magic of Zoom software, because neither Stephanie and I were prepared to go out into Ottawa traffic today because everything is extremely icy after our big snowstorm yesterday.
Are you happy, Craig, like with all of your like pro snowness?
Oh, this weekend's going to be terrific. I mean, we've got some ice on top of the snow, but once the groomers get out for, at least for cross country, this moist snow will be mixed and we'll have a good glide with enough grip that the cross country should be great up in the Gatineau Hills.
I hold you morally responsible for all of this.
So Stephanie, this is the first of our advertised special episodes. And so we're going to do three special episodes. This is the first focusing on foreign fighters. And so we're going to focus on the facts on the ground, especially in relation to Canadian foreign fighters and how we're going to do this. So we have a guest.
Yes, we have the wonderful Dr. Amar Amarsingham, famously known as our Canada's Indiana Jones for terrorist foreign fighters. He's probably Canada's best known scholar in terms of actually conducting interviews with individuals who have gone over, who have engaged in violent extremism. And I'm really looking forward to hearing his insights on threat landscape as it relates to foreign fighters. So thank you for coming on, Amar.
Thanks for having me. It's one of my more favorite nerdy podcasts. So I subscribe to it. I subscribe to several nerdy ones, including one that talks about the Netherlands of the internet and the Q phenomenon and the alt-right. So you guys are like number two or three in terms of nerdiness. It's
good. I'm glad we're just behind QAnon. That warms my heart. But Amar, maybe, you know, I kind of offered a mini introduction there, but perhaps you could go into a little bit detail of who you are and what your current research paradigm is.
Sure. Yeah. I think around 2012 or 13, shortly after the Arab Spring, I guess a lot of us noticed that, hey, there was fighters on Twitter and stuff. And so... And they were posting their breakfasts and they were posting what they were doing. And I think a few researchers said, you know, maybe we should reach out and kind of slide into their DMs and see if they'll talk to us. And so Lauren Dawson and I got a grant early on. I forget what year.
And Lauren Dawson's a professor at Waterloo.
Professor at Waterloo in the sociology department. And so we pitched this idea, I think it was 2013, to, you know, just basically build a primary interview data set of sorts, actually try to talk to fighters and supporters and families and friends of supporters to get a kind of fuller picture of this so-called process of radicalization that everyone's trying to understand. And so that started quite early on. And then, so I've been kind of watching the foreign fighter phenomenon quite closely since then, over, I think, two grants now, which is still ongoing this year. So it's been a mixture of talking to fighters online and then seeing how that whole conflict evolved over time. So now it's dealing with the returnees and stuff as well.
So in terms of your research then, who is it that is going overseas to engage in violent extremism?
So we've noticed kind of two tracks of people who've left. The ones who left very, very early on in 2012, 2013 are kind of more what I like to call, you know, the transnational activist-minded people. I don't know if that's the correct term, but they're individuals who kind of saw what was happening in Syria, saw the hundreds of thousands of people who were getting killed and chemically attacked, and decided that they can no longer kind of just stay at home and tweet about it or post on Facebook or write letters to their MPs, that they had a moral obligation, sometimes a religious obligation, to actually go do something in real life on the ground. So they're the ones who joined groups like the Free Syrian Army, Ahrar al-Sham. Some joined Jabhat al-Nusra after in 2013, and so on. And then a kind of second batch of people left sometime around late 2013 and into 2014 and 15. And a lot of these guys and girls were, I guess, much more ideologically Puritan. They saw the declaration of the caliphate as a kind of galvanizing force, wanted to go live under the caliphate, support the growth of the caliphate, have kids for the caliphate, and so on. And so one of the main kind of unique parts of this second batch of people is that a lot of women and families started to go, which we hadn't actually seen before ever. Quite a large number of women, including from Canada, started to go. Entire families started to get up and leave to basically live under the caliphate and kind of contribute to this new utopian society as opposed to just fighting for it. And so it's not cleanly divided into those two camps, but that's kind of the broader trajectories of the kinds of people who left. The second category is interesting because for them, it's they even now there's almost no mention of Assad anymore. It's not about the human rights violations, even though it's only increased. For them, it's about fighting for, dying for, contributing to the caliphate, as it was anyway. And so those are the kind of two kinds of people that left, I guess, very early on.
Can I ask, Amar, how many people are we talking about from Canada?
I guess, I mean, the Canadian numbers released by the Public Safety talk about 190 who have gone abroad to a variety of conflicts, and they say slightly around half gone to Turkey, Syria, or Iraq. That's kind of the database that I have as well, somewhere around 90 to 100 who've left to Canada, left from Canada to go fight, particularly in Syria. I think the rest are in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Libya, Lebanon, and so on. But in terms of Syria and Iraq, around 90 to 100.
So your data is consistent with what the minister said in his speech a few weeks ago in Saskatchewan, Minister Goodale. Let me just share the passage. Canada's share of this problem in relation to foreign fighters is small and basically stable, but we're not immune. Working closely with our international partners, Canada's security, intelligence, and police agencies have identified approximately 250 of these high-risk extremist travelers with a connection to Canada who have journeyed overseas, about half into Syria, Iraq, and Turkey, and the rest into Afghanistan, Pakistan, and parts of North and East Africa. Some of them have become battlefield combatants. Others did fundraising, operational planning, online propaganda, recruitment, training, and other complicit activities. Some were just camp followers. There are about 190 of these people still abroad. So that sounds consistent with your findings.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in the kind of more detailed speech that he gave now is he's kind of talked about the different roles that Canadians played. And I think this is important to keep in mind, because a lot of Canadians did go, quite a few of them fought, of course, but a lot of them did do media activity, recruitment online. And this is true for most Westerners, I think. And we saw the capture, for example, recently of Abu Ridwan, who since at least 2014 has been the voice of Al-Hayat media recordings and Al-Furqan media recordings, which are kind of English language outputs by the Islamic State, or official outputs by the Islamic State. So he admits in the prison interview that he also fought. So that's also something to keep in mind. And a lot of ISIS fighters have told me this, in that there's no like one thing that they did. They do many things. When it's time to fight, they fight. When it's not time to fight, they do other things. And so that's important, I think, for the minister to kind of unpack some of the details as well, because I think we all, particularly when we talk about the returnee debate, tend to overplay the kind of trained and ready to kill aspect of it, where a lot of these guys, particularly with the ISIS side of it, went with a sincere commitment to kind of live under the Islamic State and contribute it to a society that they thought they were building. So it's kind of much more broad than simply fighting and dying.
If I can just kind of go into that just a little bit further. I mean, we often hear from scholars who look into, radicalization of violence, that, you know, there's no single profile of individuals who go over. There's no single pathway in which someone makes a decision to actually mobilize. But what is it about that process, that decision to go overseas? Is there anything that we can say about it in terms of how it actually occurs within these individuals who have made that decision to go from, you know, downtown to Toronto to Syria, whether it's to engage in armed violence or to have a baby?
I think the context matters. So I think for if we just focus on the Islamic State for a moment, I think there were kind of push and pull factors that we can talk about. And this kind of gets cliched a little bit, but I think it's true. What we've seen with a lot of Canadians who left was a kind of whole series of push factors in terms of personal tragedy, loss of a family member, neglect and abuse at home, kind of a refugee experience, refugee trauma that kind of continued into their adolescence. All of those kind of persist. And then you had this kind of galvanizing moment, which I don't think we should underplay. Like, the Syrian conflict in the Muslim community in Canada was a major issue. And a lot of people felt like they had to do something. It was a massive movement following the Arab Spring to actually contribute in some way. Some, you know, joined NGOs, others sent clothes, and others said, "That's none of this is enough, I have to go do something." And so, you know, the way the academic literature deals with the kind of diversity of this is to say, there has to be a kind of opportune time when your push factors and your pull factors align to kind of do something, right? And so there's a lot of people who wanted to do something before Syria. It's just Syria provided the opportunity for them to go as well. It was easy to get there. You could cross over the Turkish border, at least in the early days, fairly easily. I remember I was in Turkey in 2015, and some parts of that border to Syria were just a kind of barbed wire. You could easily just climb over. It wasn't, I mean, I could have gone, no problem. And so there was a kind of logistical ease to joining the jihad in Syria that doesn't exist, for example, in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Somalia for that matter. So I think a bunch of things came together neatly with Syria, which is why I think you had a mass amount of foreign fighters mobilize and come to the country. I mean, I've talked to Belgians who said we just rented a car and drove to the border, right? And so I think there was these kind of mixture of push factors which aligned very neatly with the ease and demand and kind of moral demand that Syria signified, and so you had a kind of natural blow up of thousands of people going. That's not it's not a satisfactory answer, but I think that kind of gets at the truth. Anything more are kind of more case-by-case diversity that's just hard to get at. This is what Lauren always calls the specificity problem, right? Is that hundreds of thousands of people feel these grievances, but only about 100 react, and we still are not any closer to understanding what motivates those 100 or what didn't motivate the 900. So that's a kind of ongoing debate in the academic field on this issue.
I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that, Amar, simply because I remember when I was, you know, working in this field, we used to say that these individuals weren't winning at life. A lot of times they were dealing with like a complex array of problems. I think you've stated it far more elegantly than perhaps we did. But yeah, that it's not a single pathway, but a number of things happen and opportunity occurs. And that's basically how we got here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's true for, I think, quite a few number of people, but it's also true that, and I've talked to families of some of these guys where, you know, they were kind of at the pinnacle of their career. They succeeded quite well in kind of what ethnic South Asian or ethnic Middle Eastern would call like you succeeded at life. You've got a good job. You got married and you had a bunch of kids. And then I think some of these guys got to that point, looked around and said, this can't be all there is. Like, yeah, okay, I have a house and a car. Big deal. They still wanted that kind of sense of adventure. They wanted that sense of moral, social justice kind of oriented religiosity. And I think Syria, again, neatly allowed them to express that desire quite cleanly. So, a lot of them have very diverse set of push factors that make them, quote unquote, vulnerable. But I think the opposite is also true for quite a few of them, which is what kind of makes this difficult. This is why there's no neat kind of set of indicators that often people ask for. Is like, can you just give me a list of 15 things that I got to check mark to make sure this guy's a threat? And I'm like, well, not really.
So Amar, they went for all these reasons. What did they discover upon their arrival? And what's the situation like now? So you've had a chance to talk to those who are in detention. Kurdish forces have detained some. What was their experience like? And what is the situation like on the ground now for them?
So the situation on the ground for ISIS, I think, is I'll just kind of start with ISIS as a movement and then go into the fighters. But I think for ISIS, there isn't a whole lot left. The physical caliphate is pretty much decimated. They have maybe three villages left in Deir ez-Zor, which is right at the border with Iraq and Syria. That is left. Hajin, which they just controlled until last week, was lost, and now they have a few others left. And I think once those are gone, you're going to probably find within that last pocket a whole bunch of Western foreign fighters, as well as kind of maybe senior administrative types, if they haven't escaped already. And I suspect they've probably already escaped somewhere. But the last kind of bastion will probably be taken in the next week or two. Then we move into, I guess, the sleeping phase of ISIS, which is they'll probably retreat into the desert for a couple of years. And then when there's inevitably more instability in the Middle East and parts of Syria and Iraq, they will try to make a comeback of some sort. And so this will probably just continue for some time, unfortunately. But in terms of the fighters, currently in Kurdish custody, we have, according to the Kurdish authorities, there's about 500 men, 900 women, and 1,000 kids from 44 different countries, right? So it's a massive problem. And the Kurdish authorities have basically said, we don't have the resources to deal with these guys. We have no idea what to do with them. We have nowhere to keep them in the long term. So basically, governments have to step up and do something. Some governments in North Africa and the Middle East have taken their fighters back. I don't think many Western governments have taken their fighters back. I know one of them, Samantha, I forget her last name, was just brought back to the U.S. with a bunch of her kids. There's a Trinidadian family that just went back. But for the most part, they're still in these kind of networks of camps and prisons that dot northern Syria. So the camps that we visited, Al Roj camp, a lot of the females and kids are there. It was just basically a makeshift IDP camp with a bunch of tents. The men are all in prisons in parts of Hasaka and probably in Kobani. And some of them are much more hard to access than others. So that's the current situation in terms of the prisoners that we're looking at. In terms of Canadian prisoners, there are 4 men, 3 women, and about 7 kids. All of the 7 kids are under the age of 5, and quite a few of them are under the age of 1. They were actually born in Syria, and then I think 1 or 2 of them were actually born in the camps after capture. And so I've kind of made the argument that at the very least, Canada has a moral obligation to bring the kids back. I don't know how far that went, but I think just leaving these kids in these camps is not really sustainable in the long term. But I don't think the Kurds are going to separate the men, women, and children and send them back in different waves, because I think they quite rightly recognize that if they send back the women and children, they've lost all their leverage and no one's going to ever take the fighters back. So I think that's where we are.
So, of course, there have been some changes on the ground in Syria in relation to the U.S. presence. We have this confused situation where Trump essentially said that he was pulling out U.S. forces. We're, of course, supporting the SDF, the Kurds, and that raised a protracted discussion about what that might mean for Kurdish sustainability, since the fear would be that then the Turks would be in a position to fight the Kurds with greater success, and the Kurds will then deploy resources for that purpose, and what would happen to the detainees. So do you have a sense just strategically where this is likely to go in terms of these detainees?
Yeah, I think what the Kurds are going to do is probably make a decision, a strategic decision that we're not going to enjoy, which is that make a kind of deal with the Syrian regime or make a deal with Baghdad to have their fighters prosecuted in their own courts. I don't know what that means in terms of how the Canadians are going to respond, but it basically means that a whole host of fighters might be put on these so-called 10-minute trials and be given prison time or the death sentence. And so that I think is probably where they're leaning. There's been some rumors that, you know, they'll just open the gates of the prisons or they'll execute them themselves. And I don't think that's going to happen in terms of how the Kurds are kind of viewing the situation. Because for them, they've gained a lot of international reputation by fighting ISIS, and they're not going to just throw all of that away by committing some kind of human rights violation. So,
and what about your experience talking to detainees themselves? What sort of things were they doing while ISIS was still a going concern?
So a lot of them profess to have fought quite a bit. When they weren't fighting, they were training. When they weren't training, they helped out with some media, ISIS media, in terms of translations or that kind of thing.
Amar, just to be clear, so when you say the fighters, are you talking about all nationalities, or are you referring to specifically the Canadians that you spoke with?
So we've only spoken to Canadians who've been detained in the Kurdish areas. And so I spoke to Abu Turab, who's Muhammad Ali from Mississauga, 2 women, and that's all we were given access to when we were there for that particular trip. And so I've spoken to quite a bit of returnees in Europe and North America, but I think in terms of prisoners, those are the only 3 we were given access to. So kind of combining, I guess, their experiences, it seems like a lot of them were frontline fighters, but also contributed and helped with things like media. The ISIS police force, which is known as the Hizbah, a kind of moral police, a police force that's in charge particularly of enforcing Sharia on the ground, and things of that nature. So there is no kind of one role that the foreign fighters were given, which was, I think, the initial assumption by a lot of analysts, which was to say all the Westerners did recruitment in media, or they were simply used as cannon fodder by those who are really in charge, and that's all they've ever been used for. But I think what we're starting to see with the capture and returnees is that, no, they were actually, you know, pretty high up. And some were given pretty high level responsibilities. We know, for example, that the leader of the so-called Anwar Awlaki Brigade, which was a brigade of English-speaking fighters in right shortly after the caliphate was established, was led by a Canadian, and that he had been killed sometime during the Raqqa siege. And so I think Canadians have been front and center for a lot of these major operations that happened within the Islamic State.
Can I ask, Omar, do you have some sense, so if the statistics from public safety and the minister are 190 persons still abroad, not all of which are in Syria, Turkey, and in Iraq, but probably about half are, some of them are dead. Mm-hmm. So do you have a sense as to the proportion of those who traveled and arrived in that theater who are likely still alive? Do you have any data on that?
I don't have any data on how many are alive, but I've confirmed about 22 at least who have been killed. I suspect there are a lot more have been killed. It's just, I think, particularly once the Mosul campaign started and the Raqqa campaign started, we saw news of kind of mass deaths of ISIS fighters thrown into mass graves and kind of bulldozed into a big hole in the ground. And so I think a lot of our fighters, a lot of Western fighters, are probably amongst those who died in the last kind of major battles of Mosul and Raqqa. It's just the way in which they died, we'll probably never be able to confirm who they are, when they died, or anything like that. And I think one of the, several of the fighters who left from Quebec, for example, stopped responding to their families around this time. Several fighters from Ontario stopped responding to their families around this time. So I think it's safe to assume that they're probably killed, but there's no confirmation in any real sense, and we'll probably never get confirmation for the fighters who died in the last year or so, because it's just too chaotic.
If I can, I would say, just from a national security perspective, what you also worry about, though, is that even if people die, you worry that, you know, a lot of times their documents have been confiscated by the organization, and those documents can then be passed on as well. So you, even if they're dead, you have to treat them as potentially still a threat, simply because someone else could have been handed their passport or birth certificate or other forms of identification that can be used to travel.
Yeah, the threshold for declaring someone dead from a national security standpoint is probably much higher than mine. But I think, and rightly so, because I think for me, it's like, oh, the parents got a call from some emir in Syria. It's probably sufficient. But yeah, from a national security standpoint, I mean, we know that fake passports were found, for example, at the site of the Paris attack with other people's names on them. And so it has happened before. And ISIS, we've learned from kind of refugees who were interviewed and even fighters who were interviewed that basically ISIS trained people in how to do that kind of thing, right? To kind of change their name and change their documents and go back into Europe to try to launch attacks. And so particularly the external operations wing of ISIS was definitely using other documents to do what they wanted to do. So I think it's probably a valid concern. But in terms of dead, I mean, yeah, there's about 22 that I've been able to confirm, but probably much higher than that. Another 22 have either returned or been captured by Kurdish forces or Turkish forces. And so we're getting to the number, you know, we're getting to about half or a little bit more than half accounted for. The other half, it's very difficult to know at the moment.
So then, like, if this is the situation, what is really going to happen next on the ground in that area? I mean, the New York Times is reporting that, you know, several estimates have suggested there's 20 to 30,000 fighters left in the area. As you said, they're probably going to go into a sleep phase, the desert phase, perhaps. But what should we really be expecting next?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. There's only small spits of land that are remaining in the deserts of Iraq and Syria where these fighters are remaining. The Assad forces will probably take back a bit, and the Kurdish forces will take back a bit, and then we'll have to wait to see what happens next. I think the kind of elephant in the room is what the Americans are going to do. If the Americans do pull out of Syria, it'll probably create a whole bunch of instability in terms of what happens with the Kurds in Turkey and so on, that might complicate matters for the Islamic State and even other rebel groups going forward. I know for a fact that research will end, like the access to any of these prisons or access to any of these camps will probably come to a close, as a lot of the Kurdish fighters will probably be on the lookout for what Turkey's going to do and so on. But I think that's kind of what we can expect is a kind of sleep phase followed by uncertainty or more chaos.
So Amar, let's move to the issue of returnees, which of course has been much in the news here in Canada. And there's a fair amount of perhaps misunderstanding in this area, but let's just set this up. So the fear, of course, with the number of foreign fighters going to this theater was that should they return, it would be the equivalent of kicking the dandelion as it's gone to seed. You'd have people coming back who are equipped with capacity in terms of their knowledge in the use of weapons, perhaps their bomb-making abilities, their operational effectiveness, much in excess of what they would otherwise had they only stayed in Canada or other countries, and therefore they would be more lethal. And there was some statistical information from prior foreign fighter experiences. So I'm thinking here of the research that Thomas Hedgeheimer did up to about 2010, suggesting that in fact returnees were more lethal when they did engage in violence, and that actually being a returnee was one of the better predictors as to whether one was likely to engage in domestic acts of terrorism violence. Although it wasn't a huge indicator, it was a significant one. So has that played out, that fear, to date?
In Canada, no. I think we've mixed up a few things. I think for example, just in terms of numbers in Canada, my database has about 22 returnees.
Sorry, Amar, you mean 22 returnees from Iraq and Syria?
Yeah. Okay. So 22 returnees from Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. So let me unpack that a little bit, because I think my definition, I kept it kind of particularly broad, so we could capture quite a bit. So that 22 number includes individuals who never actually made it to Syria. That number includes individuals who are currently in custody with the YPG or by the Turkish government. And so I kind of cast the net fairly broad. And even with the net cast broad, it still only leaves us with 22. And of the 22, only 12 actually made it into Syria and joined any kind of organization. The other 10 were caught in Egypt and sent home, or Turkey and sent home. And so they never actually made it. So the way I define returnee is quite broad in terms of anyone who's left Canada with the intent of joining some kind of listed organization abroad. And so it doesn't you didn't have to actually make it into Syria and Iraq to be included.
When you say 22 returnees, you're not saying 22 fighters. You're saying 22 individuals who made the attempt, failed, and have been, you know, subsequently detained elsewhere.
Yeah, so 10 of them didn't even make it into Syria and Iraq. They made it into a variety of other countries like Turkey or Egypt, and then were basically captured and sent home. So this includes, for example, the three girls from Brampton who traveled very early on in, I think, 2014, who were 15 years old, 18 years old, and 19 years old to try to make it to Syria. They made it to Egypt and got sent back. There are others similarly who kind of made it into Turkey, like the woman who was recently found guilty, Rehab Dugmoş, of the Canadian tire attack, who made it into Turkey and then got captured and sent home. And so there are a few individuals who I include in the database who, you know, never actually made it into Syria. So only about 12 that I know of the 22 actually traveled into Syria or were able to get in. Of the 22, only 4 have been charged, and that includes 2 of them who made it into Syria. So that's Kevin Omar Mohammed from Waterloo, Ismail Habib from Quebec, and then 2 others who haven't made it into Iraq and Syria, the Canadian tire attack woman, and then Pamir Hakamzadeh, who was from Toronto. And so the way in which I think we define returnee, it's the way in which I define returnee is quite broad. But if we talk about just the ISIS fighters who have come back, it's a kind of a minuscule number of ones and twos that we know of who've come back. That includes the famous Abu Huzaifa from the podcast, from the New York Times podcast, and one other individual from Western Canada. So this kind of assumption, I guess, that's been thrown around in the public that, you know, all of these returnees, all of these 60 returnees are hardened ISIS fighters ready to kill you, is just not true. And I think it's important, and I'm glad the public safety minister kind of unpacked some of those numbers, because I think it went around unchallenged and created a lot of unnecessary fears in the minds of many Canadians.
Okay, so let me just jump in there, Amar, with the statement from the minister's most recent speech. There are close to 60 individuals who left Canada and are now back. a small number from that Syria, Iraq, Turkey theater, but most from elsewhere. And so of the 60, a small number of those are returnees from the theater that we've been focusing on here, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. And now what's missing from the most recent public report on the terrorism threat this year, which had similar numbers, last year's report said of that small number, a majority had engaged in combat.
Mm.
This year's report doesn't have that statement. And that seems to be consistent with what you're telling us.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to know what they did when they were over there. But I think a lot of the women, for example, never engaged in combat. And we've spoken with at least two of them who were captured by the YPG. And they basically said we were trapped, you know, we just lived in a house and with our children and our husband would come and go. So they didn't actually do anything. In terms of Abu Turab, who's currently in custody, he definitely engaged in combat. Abu Ridwan, who's currently in custody, he definitely engaged in combat. But they also had a whole other host of things that they did.
And by custody, you mean custody with the Kurds?
With the Kurds, currently, yeah.
So they're not returnees?
They're not back yet, but I kind of include them in the number under the assumption they're eventually going to be returnees. But this is the thing, is that even with my net cast quite wide, the numbers are pretty low. But there's also a guy who's currently in Turkish custody who hasn't been charged with anything, who, you know, most of us think traveled to Syria to join Jabhat al-Nusra, who hasn't been brought back either. So there's a whole bunch of cases that are floating around that we're kind of unsure about. But the idea that they were all trained, I think the assumption for many Canadians is that these guys were all trained to launch attacks in the West, right? They were going to be sent back to kind of launch attacks, Paris-style attacks in the West. And I don't think that's particularly accurate. I think a lot of them, of course, engaged in combat because that's what they went there to do. But as far as we know, none of them were really part of this kind of external operations wing of the Islamic State that carried out the Brussels attacks or the Paris attacks.
So given everything you've just said, Stuart Bell, who we often refer to on this podcast, had documents which said that at one point the RCMP was expecting hundreds of potential returnees or quite a number of returnees coming back. That doesn't seem to be the case. Does Canada have the right approach to the, you know, there's a number of questions we could ask, whether it's about the individuals who are in custody right now, whether, like, you know, do we have the right approach with regards to people who are here? Are there any recommendations that you might make with regards to our both foreign fighter and returnee policies?
Yeah. I think Canada's approach in terms of prevention has been really good, particularly the focus on violence as opposed to just kind of what's in your head has been quite important and quite different from, I think, other countries or how other countries approach the problem. Like the marshalling government resources in the prevention space, particularly with the use of kind of local NGOs and local community activists and NGO groups has been quite effective, I think, and has brought the community on board in an important way. In terms of returnees and kind of people coming out of prison, I don't think we're ready. I don't think we have a program in place to rehabilitate and reintegrate this population in any meaningful way. And I think that's kind of fundamentally necessary. The larger problem is that a lot of people who are coming back aren't being charged. And so it's hard to kind of encourage them to get help either for their PTSD or their some kind of trauma or their kind of radical ideas when you can't make it a requirement. And so we've noticed this, for example, with Abu Huzaifa, who's from the famous New York Times podcast, where he hasn't really accepted any kind of help offered by the community or even the RCMP, because he's basically said, you haven't charged me with anything, so what's in it for me to take on this kind of help? I don't think there's anything wrong with me, and so on. And so once you charge people, I think you can kind of mandate them to do something. But when if you have a solid chunk of individuals who are back and you can't charge them because you have no idea what they did in Syria, then we're going to have a problem where they're just kind of wandering the streets. They require some kind of help. The communities into which they're released don't know how to deal with them. And then there's a real problem going forward in terms of what they might do in recidivism and that kind of stuff. Then there's the problem of children. I think with a little bit of help, we could probably be ready for the kids, because there's not a whole lot of them. There's only about seven that we know of so far. There's been this assumption that we have to kind of rebuild an entirely new framework in Canada to deal with these ISIS, so-called ISIS kids. And I don't think that's accurate. I think with a kind of network of child psychologists and child psychiatrists we already have in the country who are used to dealing with the issues that these kids are probably going to be experiencing, things like interrupted education or early exposure to violence and childhood neglect and death of a parent. With a little bit of training on the Syria context and the ISIS context, they could probably handle the issue quite easily. We don't need to kind of reinvent the wheel, so to speak. So I think for the women, for the kids, we're probably better prepared than we are for some of these more hardened fighters that might come back that we can't charge. And so that I think is what we'll need to figure out going forward. We've tried peace bonding a few of the individuals who traveled to Turkey and came back, but you know, the peace bonds expired and they're just kind of going about their day. There's no real follow-up. And we remember what happened with Aaron Driver when there was no follow-up. And so I think,
Aaron Driver, the individual who was killed as he was trying to potentially carry out a terror attack in southwestern Ontario.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, his peace bond was expiring, and there was a whole bunch of things associated with the peace bond that he didn't like, and was kind of reacting to that and calls for attacks from ISIS and so on. So I think part of the problem with the peace bond approach itself has been, you know, you kind of slap individuals with the peace bond, but there's no real community follow-up. There's no real attempt to make use of the fact that you have them in a contained environment to actually help them in some way. That I think all those issues I think are going to pertain even going forward with the returning issue.
So I guess the last question, Amar, and you hinted at this at one of your earlier responses, is that, you know, you've kind of made an argument for bringing people back, but we're in this kind of climate where, you know, A, we're heading into an election, and B, there's kind of been this very strong hysteria around the idea of foreign fighters. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, foreign fighters are, as we've discussed, dangerous and a real problem. So I was wondering, can you make your case once again for why you think Canada should maybe play a role in bringing some of these individuals back?
And let me, Amar, before you get that, let me continue with what the minister said in his speech. He says that a few of these terrorist travelers with a nexus to Canada are known to be in the custody of the Kurds in Syria, in a volatile and dangerous region with no effective governance, where Canada has no diplomatic presence. It should be noted that while every Canadian citizen, no matter how reprehensible, has the legal right to re-enter Canada, the government of Canada has no legal obligation to facilitate their return.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of understand, and you guys have talked about this before on your podcast in terms of the legal issues around Canadian law enforcement interfering overseas and what that might lead to. So I kind of get it from a legal and political point of view. I also think leaving them there will have long-term consequences that we're not foreseeing. So if the Americans pull out, or if Turkey invades, or these kinds of things happen, which are quite likely to happen if certain things fall into place, I don't know what that means for Canadians in custody and what that could mean going forward in terms of our responsibilities and so on. I think the fact that we're going into an election season this year, and with the kind of ISIS returnee issue constantly in the media, I don't imagine that the Canadian government's going to make any moves to bring anybody back, at least until well after the election. I don't think the Prime Minister wants to go into election season with, hey, we brought back five men, four women, and seven kids, some of whom we know were pretty high level with the Islamic State. And so that's not a good election campaign slogan. So I think we're probably not going to see any movement on the issue for some time, which worries me a little bit, considering that what we're seeing with the United States and Turkey and what's happening in the Kurdish regions. So we'll have to see what happens. But I think it's all, for me, it strikes me as a good move to just bring them back and try them here, or do your best to try them here. But again, I know how difficult that could be, particularly with some of these cases where you have zero evidence aside from a Twitter feed that they did anything while they were over there.
Well, thanks very much, Amar, for joining us. You set us up very nicely for our follow-up conversations in terms of discussing the legal options, in terms of that prospect you raised of charging and prosecuting here, as well as a legal discussion about the implications of being detained by the Kurds in a non-international armed conflict. So that'll be the focus of our next podcast. And then we'll get into a broader conversation about policy options, which you've also set up very nicely. So thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We both follow your work extensively. So, you know, it's nice to have you come on the podcast finally and talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, no, it's great. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Thanks, everyone.
See you next time.